Just to keep me honest, I'm recording this. I hope nobody minds. No, I do this normally. If you go to my website, you'll see I have about 50 of my talks recorded. This is not meant to be a threat or anything like that. But in any case, I want to talk about something that's quite different from what I actually submitted as the one-pager, but I think is kind of relevant, given that I hadn't realized there would be so much confusion about what transformative might mean. And so what I want to talk about, in fact, is something that I'm working on now, which is the basis of a new book with a co-author of mine, Veronica Lipinska, which is on an important distinction, I think, makes the distinction between transformative and other kinds of research or modes of being or whatever significant. And that is between preactionary and proactionary. Okay. Now the precautionary principle is a principle I think most of you will be familiar with if you're used to environmental politics and so forth. And it was alluded to a little bit yesterday, and it has to do with the idea that, in a sense, you should really think out the risks in advance of what should be done, and if it looks like there may be some undefined sort of harms that are in the way, that you should withhold or restrain yourself from acting in certain capacities. This principle is often used as a sort of environmental policy. It gets used to justify a wide variety of things, including the curtailment of population growth, the curtailment of industrial development, and it presupposes a certain kind of ideal of what it is to live a sort of decent human existence, which is one that is, generally speaking, in balance or in equilibrium with nature, and frankly does not subscribe to any kind of overarching notion of progress or human domination of nature. Okay? And so the precautionary principle is one that is invoked in that way. And in the UK recently, the Green Party has put out a white paper called Guardians for the Future, where the precautionary principle is being advanced as a kind of, you might say, normative ideal for thinking about future generations, and in fact actually advocating that there be a certain branch of government, or at least a sort of check on government, where any policies that are enacted by Parliament could be, in principle, vetoed or sent back for reconsideration if it looks like it would harm future generations. Now, of course, this has not been enacted in the UK, but the point is this is something that is on the agenda of the Green Party, which at the moment only has one MP, but in a sense that there is some kind of momentum going on about this. So that's one sort of view. I think it's quite a familiar view. The proactionary principle, which is the one that myself and my co-author are going to be defending in the book, is the exact opposite. In fact, it is about trying to encourage and, in a way, to educate and train people to accept and welcome the taking of risk. Okay? The idea of the proactionary principle is, and I think that if one wants to talk about transformative research, that in a sense, this is the ultimate goalpost, is a sort of proactionary orientation. I talked a little bit about this yesterday with regard to in response to Dan Sarowitz, because I think, in a sense, we can't think about transformative research simply in terms of, you know, being able to satisfy things that people already are trying to achieve or accomplish in their own lives, but in a sense, getting people to rethink what their own lives are about, and perhaps to sort of, as it were, scale up their ambitions with regard to what it is like, what it is to be a human being. And of course, we need a society that is willing to sustain the taking of those sorts of risks. And I think one of the things that's quite interesting from the standpoint of the sort of welfare state environment in which we live, which is the context in which state-supported science funding comes from, is that typically, you know, welfare state orientation has been one of actually discouraging people from taking risks in the sense that we engage a lot in preventive measures, right? So if you think about, for example, state-supported medical research is to a large extent about getting people to stop smoking, stop eating, stop doing things, right, to sort of curtail their existence in various sorts of ways. And one of the consequences of that, of course, is if people actually do those sorts of things in advance, then there will be less of a taxpayer's burden in terms of supporting the kind of health issues that will arise down the road. So you can see it from a sort of cost-benefit standpoint. If you're looking from the standpoint of a sort of steady-state model, that discouraging people from taking a lot of risks in advance will save a lot of money to taxpayers eventually, and so you want people to sort of minimize their risk-taking ability, and the welfare state sort of encourages that. But it's not at all clear that this is really, you know, if we really want to think about human beings as sort of a distinctive species that actually, as it were, has the potential, at least this is what science presupposes, of comprehending all of reality and all of nature in some sort of way, that this is the way we should be acting. We should always be in this kind of risk-minimizing mode. And so the question then becomes, what is the context in which, you know, the kind of social welfare system that we would need to actually encourage and enable people to take risks and, as it were, to be able to survive the consequences of the negative aspects of taking risk. And so, in effect, I am talking about a sort of extended welfare state system. Okay? But one that, in a sense, would lead to a sort of general empowerment of humanity. And this is what the proactionary principle I take it to be about if we really take it as a kind of a social principle that could be implemented. See, transformative research is defined in terms of high risk, high reward. And I think if we're going to take that sort of idea seriously, then we really need to have, as it were, all of society subscribed into the idea. And so part of what science policy needs to be about is to actually persuade people to think about their lives in a much more expansive sense and to encourage a certain kind of risk seeking, which at the same time could be protected socially. And that's kind of the general principle that I'm aiming for here with my co-author, it really gives a sort of, in a sense, this is kind of what you might say if you want a scientifically informed existence, what that really is about. Because if you were to take the precautionary principle or any of the sort of risk-averse principles that we seem to often be operating under now, and you go back to the past and you actually implement them, we would never have had the Industrial Revolution, for example. We would never have had many of the revolutions that, in fact, have been massively transformative. Because people would be calculating in advance how much risk, you know, they would have to take, right? Was it worth it? And people wouldn't have done it. And so there's a sense in which you need to actually provide a sort of secure environment to encourage people to take those kinds of risks in the future. Because science is actually opening up for us many opportunities to move forward. But we really don't have the culture in which people are willing to sort of embrace that as something they can identify with. It's seen very much as the enemy, and we've already heard a lot about that here. And so part of the mission, as it were, of transformative research is actually to sort of convince people to get on board with this idea that a scientific capacity that we are on the verge of coming up with is actually something people should embrace and sort of take into their own lives as something worth acting on in their own existence. But this involves, you know, really rethinking quite radically what the welfare state is about and as it were, increasing our sense of what it is to ensure people. And I'll stop there and take questions, because this is, in a sense, sort of putting things, you know, on the table that we really haven't thought very seriously about yet, but it's about integrating science more fully into human self-conception. Okay, thank you.
Okay, so my question is this. At first, I thought I understood that you wanted to encourage people to take risks.
Yes. And I want it securitized.
That's the interesting part.
Yes, that's the point. I want an improved welfare state.
You want to make it safer for people.
Exactly. Because obviously there's going to be a lot of failure. We already know that. And the thing is, you know, how are you going to encourage that and also make it viable? So you have to securitize.
What if you just reward people for trying, even if they fail, rather than making it safer.
Well, no. Safer, no. What I mean is securitized. I want everybody paying into a system where it turns out that only a few people will take the relevant risks. That's the general idea, okay? So the point is, you know, you're not forced to take risks. You can take risks if you want to, but everyone will subsidize it because the benefits from it will potentially accrue to everyone if we have a system where the information from the consequences of taking that risk is funneled through the society. So there's a lot of presuppositions I'm making here about the flow of information and knowledge from the risks that are taken. But that's the idea, okay? Yes.
Right.
At least in terms of the payment for it.
Well, so I'm wondering how appropriate is it to do something like that through an institution like NSF and through something like transformative research? Because I think the part of the problem, which is something that Ed was talking about yesterday, was that if you wanted to do something like make a page limit for how much you could write as an academic, that would be really difficult to do unless you've got prestigious institutions on board. And I'm worried. I guess my concern is that you have a system that is not the science institution is not the most democratic system.
No.
Right. So how would you go about democratizing risk in that way and be able to get scientific institutions and prestigious educational institutions on board because it's not in their best interest?
No.
Mm-hmm. Take on this sort of like innovative step. They don't.
No, in a sense, to be honest with you, ideally, I would go back and renegotiate the social contract of the NSF, right? Just like in the after World War II. Well, I'm sorry. Okay, you know, but in a sense, you know, we're in a different world than existed after the end of World War II. In a sense, we're sort of path dependent on a decision taken shortly after World War II with regard to what the National Science Foundation should be. Okay, and it seems to me that now, given that we've not only gone beyond the Cold War, we're in this sort of new space. It wouldn't be a bad idea to renegotiate what the social contract is. And my point is, I want all of society on board with a so-called National Science Foundation. They need to be invested in it, you see? And I would actually like people to, as it were, be willing to volunteer themselves and take the kind of risks that can contribute to cutting-edge scientific knowledge, to participate in scientific experiments of a sort of radical sort, and if they go wrong, they get compensated for it. That's the kind of world I'm talking about here.
Yeah. So, I guess this goes further to a multi-part question. Based on your last statement, I'd like to ultimately get you to talk more about why you think it's important to take those kinds of risks.
Yeah.
I first want to say it seems to me that in the U.S. at least, the way the economy works here, and this is a huge cultural factor, there's a huge cultural embracing of the proactionary principle, and that people are this whole idea that of kind of an entrepreneurial society.
But I want it collectivized.
But let me just finish.
Okay.
There's huge willingness to take risks, maybe justified by, or maybe rationalized by everyone's belief that they could become Bill Gates. There's gigantic experimentation,
yes,
technological on the front end.
But the information is not collectivized.
Yes, so the problem isn't the taking of risks. The problem is the collectivization.
Exactly.
So it seems to me that your portrayal of this is actually it's somewhat deceptive.
It's socialism 2.0. Okay.
So which is great. So fine. So rather than talk about NSF.
Kelly brought up NSF. I was talking about this in a sort of broader context, in a sense, okay? But insofar as NSF is the sort of flagship science policy organization for the United States, it's a worthy target.
How do you really distinguish this from the precautionary principle, given that the culture of risk actually already exists and flourishes?
Because the thing is, we do not collect the benefits of risk-taking, okay? Risk-taking has a lot of epistemic benefits, which are not being collected together.
The epistemic benefits.
Well, yes, because you can't. There are a lot of things about all of the new technologies and new forms of science that we're developing that we're really not going to know the consequences of unless people actually take the risks to sort of, you know, do them themselves and be these things. And the point is that sometimes people do take the risks.
Don't you think that's happening in this?
But it isn't collectivized. The thing is, the information is privatized, right?
Yes.
Certain individuals take the risks, and then they bear the costs, right? But the point is, the whole society doesn't benefit from it. And that's the thing that I'm concerned about. Yes, you're absolutely right. There's an entrepreneurial spirit in the society, but the benefits and the costs are privately accrued.
Right.
Yes, and that's what I'm addressing. I want these things to be collectivized so that everyone can benefit from them.
Carl. Well, I agree with Dan. It doesn't seem to me like you're doing anything more than just articulating the ideology that we live in.
No, we don't live in that, I'm afraid. I mean...
Well, insofar as you're contrasting precautionary with proactionary, you are.
Well, I'm on the precautionary side, which is not actually... The official policy. Now, you as a social policy.
Well, the collectivization, I agree that that's.
But that's an important point.
Well, but you haven't got it up there, and you got the basic contrast. You got enough dots on dot collectivization up there. At least type in collectivization.
Okay.
All right, Luis. So maybe I'm seeing all these being wrong, but as you were talking, I got this idea of getting a lot of teenager boys in really crappy cars trying to drive as fast as they can.
Look, frankly...
Let me just...
No, but there is a truth to that, right? There's truth to that.
Yes, that scares the shit out of me.
Well, I don't care what scares the shit out of you, right? That's not the issue. No, that's the problem. It's natural selection only if it's privatized. That's the point.
So that is scary to me, and it actually was very useful because it reminded me of something else, which is the fact that if you are thinking about transformative research in terms of let's ask the biggest questions that you can think of, you don't need to be particularly creative to think about what are the biggest questions that we need to answer, because those are written everywhere. I mean, science, for instance, a few years ago had 155 questions that we want to answer. So it's actually easy to find what the big questions are. The question is, who should we encourage to try to answer them? And the point is that when you think about high risk and high reward, I think that people that sometimes think about clever ways to solve some of those problems do not see them as high risk. That they really think, I can solve this. And I think when we are talking about transformative high risk research, I think that one thing that we ought to consider also is that, and I'm going to sound very elitist in this, not everybody should be allowed to try to solve them, because many people have shown repeatedly that they have no capacity to actually to try to solve those, and it would be really high risk to give the money to them to try to solve them, which would be exactly the same thing as letting be no speed limit to the so-called teenage boy with a crappy car.
Look, our notions of risk versus uncertainty only date from the 1920s. So if you're looking at Frank Knight, I mean, before Frank Knight, there wasn't really a clear distinction between risk and uncertainty. And so if you look at the people who took risks in the Industrial Revolution, they would probably fall under your category of ignorant people. Okay? And so the point is that people will take whatever risks they think, or they may not even think that they are risks. And so I'm, in a way, I'm not so concerned about that. People will do whatever they will do. The interesting thing will be whether we can securitize, that is to say, if they actually have bad consequences, we'll be able to in some way remediate them, and also whether we'll be able to learn from the consequences of whatever they do. But I don't care in advance whether they've calculated the probabilities correctly, because in a sense, this kind of discussion we're having now about risk really only was made possible as a concept in the 1920s, and people beforehand were taking all kinds of quote, risks that turned out to be okay. But I think what we're lacking at the moment is a capacity to learn from whatever kinds of risks people take in a kind of collective way. I think that's what's lacking. And we also lack an environment in which people are encouraged in the sense that they might be, remedied or rewarded or something for having taken the risks, even if the consequences are negative.
Okay, William, we have 1 minute.
I find the idea very interesting, and I particularly in opposition to the idea of precaution. But I just wanted to make an observation about the way in which we are dealing with risk in the UK. And the thing that worries me most about this is in the sphere of pensions policies, where precisely the reverse situation is playing out. That is to say that a system which was highly collectivised, both through a state pension system and through the generalisation of, you know, of private sector collectivised pensions through large companies in particular, this is completely collapsed.
I know, and that's a real problem.
A situation where it seems to me that society is declaring an incapacity to collectivise.
And that's wrong.
It may be wrong. It may be wrong. But the empirical facts are that we are not finding ways to collectivise risk. Quite the reverse. We are declaring a kind of sense of despair.
Well, this is an agenda item for us then, okay? That's the point. That's an agenda item for us then.
It seems to me that my concern here is that your thesis is based on an assumption that we can do things which
I know politics is against it. Yeah.
We are declaring a failure to.
No, exactly. No. And I agree with you 100% as to what the political problem is at the moment with regard to this issue. Yes. But I think the point that I would remind everybody in the room about with regard to socialism vis-a-vis capitalism, right, is the point is that with somebody like Marx, for example, the idea wasn't to just dismiss the idea that there was entrepreneurship and risk-taking and so forth, but to collectivize the benefits of it. That was part of what the Marxist message was about. It wasn't about being against risk and against the sorts of things that made capitalism different from previous economic systems, but by socializing the process. And this is what I'm talking about here, upgrading it for this kind of world in which we live. And I think it's very unfortunate that, in fact, we have become very disaffected from the welfare state. I think that's a real big problem, and that's, in a sense, a real big rhetorical problem that faces us today. Because risk is now individualized. And that is the biggest problem we've got here.
On that note.
Okay.